Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, John from the Lano Group in Maryland.
My, oh my. Quakertown, Pennsylvania. Who'd have believed it? I'm John and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
And I am humbled and honored to be here tonight. It is it's an amazing gift. It's an amazing story, actually. When Sarah called me, I had just finished preaching in the church that I pastor. And I had preached out of a small prayer in the Old Testament, trying to challenge our church to go further, to accept risks, to take on new opportunities, and to go wherever they were called. And I got out of there, and the phone was ringing in my car, and it was someone from Quakertown, Pennsylvania, asking me to come here. And I said, you know, God, I was talking to them, not me. And I told Sarah, if you had called me an hour and a half ago, I probably wouldn't have come. But I am grateful, and I am blessed that I have the opportunity to come up. It's always nervous, a little bit nervous when you come up because there's a bunch of strangers, and then you remember they were all part of the same family, the same fellowship. And then you get comfortable again, and you make new friends, and you find out new truth. And I like the prayer that you just read about setting aside what we think we know and trying to discover what is true. And there's a lot of folks in this room that are a lot brighter than I am. But what I hope that you will get out of tonight is the simple truth, the two truths that I know, that alcohol drinking will take you places you can't possibly imagine, that if any of us would see where it would lead to, none of us would have ever taken that first drink. It'll take you to shame and pain and humiliation and despair. But that recovery can also take you to places you would never believe. And my life is the truth of both of those statements. I am sober since December 23rd, 1983, which, if my way of counting is correct, means that in less than a week I have an anniversary coming up. And this year I will be celebrating both my 29th year and my 30th sober Christmas. So it is a wonderful time of the year for me. I have a home group. I have three home groups because I'm an alcoholic and I don't leave anything easily. So I have three home groups and none of them really claim me, but they all have to admit, and if they check the rolls, that I am a part of them. But let's get into the reality of my drinking. I was born an alcoholic. I don't know if there really is such a thing as a natural born alcoholic, but mine seems to fit that because the very first drink I ever had tasted like more. You know, that if I just had one more, it was so good that one more would be just about perfect. And I always kept looking for that more. You know, and I had all those tough questions that alcoholics always have. Like, you know, the hardest question in the world for an alcoholic is when you're sitting at somebody's house and they get a bottle and they give you a glass and they start pouring and they say when? You know, and you're sitting here watching them fill it up and then eventually you notice a look of horror on their face and you pretend like you weren't paying attention. Oh, I'm sorry, you know, when? You know, and right before it spills over the top, you know. And that's the way I always drank. That's the way I always drank. I was born into what people would call a normal middle-class family. That was people that didn't live inside the walls of my house, but it was a middle-class family. I have one sister and a brother and a half. I call him a half-brother because until he died, I always thought he was my uncle. He was one of those family secrets that nobody ever talked about. And then I found out and discovered that I had a brother that I had never known. I had a mom and a dad, and they stayed together for the kids. And there were a lot of days I wished they would just separate for the kids, or at least let us separate from them. I grew up in a home where my father was a violent drunk. My grandfather was a violent drunk, and I was scared to death of anger because I believed that gene that was in my grandfather and my father was in me. My grandfather had been killed in a bar fight, and my father used to punch walls and kids and refrigerators and stuff on a regular basis around our house. And it was just this violent anger that lived in him, and it was just oppressive. And my mother was a mild-mannered alcoholic that used to get drunk and want to start fights with this violent drunk. And I used to sit upstairs and pray, don't say that, because you knew those buzzwords that was going to turn the house into a horror show. And I blame my mother for my father's anger and all that other nonsense that went along with it. I don't blame my parents for my disease. I have a sister and a brother that grew up in that same household. My sister drinks. She still has a bottle of wine in her house that she bought in 1978. You know, we go over every Christmas, she'll take that bottle of wine out and say, does anybody want to drink? And if nobody does, it'll go back in the refrigerator. It drives me nuts, you know. You know, and I look every year, and it is still there, you know. And I got a brother who drinks socially. But for me, alcohol always tasted like more. I just loved it. I got a friend that tells me that he's known a lot of social drinkers, but most social drinkers' time of season of social drinking was in elementary school. But for me, it was. You know, I enjoyed drinking, and I wanted to start early. You know, the nice thing about growing up with alcoholics is there's a lot of substance around the house. My father bought booze by the case, and they never counted it. The only thing my dad ever counted was that once upon a time, a company named Falstaff came out with these little pony cakes that went in the refrigerators. And they promised that you would get 72 glasses of beer out of this thing. And my father being the, you know, put it in the refrigerator, and he had a little index card, and he would check them off, you know. And he never got to 72, and, you know, and he never knew that he had someone helping him with the count. Because when I would come home from school, I would open up the refrigerator and get a quick glass of, you know, beer and drink that, and then fill it up with Coke when Mom came into the kitchen, you know. And so he would write letters to Falstaff, and he would get on the phone and scream at him and talk to customers. I probably helped him because he got three or four free kegs from Falstaff. He was able to pull it. Mr. Rudd, we're not sure why yours doesn't work. Everybody else seems to work, you know. And so, you know, it was just that type stuff. I just loved drinking. You know, I just loved it. And it just seemed to make things more peaceful and more joyful. And it made me a better person and a better dancer and a better athlete, you know. And there are a lot of choices that go along with drinking, you know. And there always are choices in the beginning about, wow, can I drink this or can I drink that? And eventually it becomes choices. What is the cost of this drink? What am I going to have to give up to keep drinking like this? And that's the way my life went. I drank all my way through school. I got to the time when I was graduating from high school and had no idea what I was going to do next. And then went and took my SATs, and they found out that I had a higher intelligence than my grade average would indicate. And I got accepted into the University of Maryland and moved off and went on to college, you know. And I drank my way through 4 years of University of Maryland. And it was an exciting time. I knew exactly how far it was from the main campus to the Washington, D.C. line where you could go to a liquor store. And I knew exactly what time the pool hall opened and what time the bars closed. And I had a hard time finding out what time my history class met, you know. But I got through the University of Maryland. Don't remember much. When later on I went back and got a master's degree, and they always talk about these books that you had to have read in college. And I knew none of them. And yet I've got a piece of paper that says I read them. You know, and so that was the type of deal that was going on. And I drank all the way through college. Everybody did. You know, that's just normal stuff. And that was back in the early 60s, and there were protest marches going on. And my mother would sit in front of the television and be worried to death about her poor child at risk in that terrible place over in College Park. And then one night she saw me on the evening news throwing an empty bottle, always an empty bottle of booze at a National Guardsman, and she quit worrying and started praying. And that was the way life was going on. And it was just, I went to protest marches not because I had deep moral convictions, but because all the hot girls went to protest marches. You know, and that was where I was going. And there was a lot of marijuana and stuff at protest marches. And there was a lot of booze at protest marches. And I liked all of it. And I went. I graduated from the University of Maryland and had no idea what I was going to do with my life. My advisor pointed out that after 4 years at the University of Maryland, I was qualified to do nothing. And so we turned around and we tried to work some things out, and I ended up teaching school. Now, teaching school was an exciting opportunity. I was going to mold young people. I was going to teach civics to young kids, and I was going to teach them how to be a good citizen. You know, and I was really excited about it. I spent all summer working on my first day's lesson plan. I got through the first day, and I felt great, and I found out I had to come back and do it again tomorrow, and I didn't have a whole summer to get ready. You know, and it got real scary. Then about the third day that I was teaching school, in this terror and in this fog, the principal of the school asked me if I would do him a favor. My free period was the last period of the day, and ride to the bank with him. Now, he was done that day. He would ride to the bank, put the cafeteria money in the deposit, come back, drop me off, never go back in the building, and go home. You know, on the way back from driving to the bank, he asked me to open up his glove box, and he had a half pint of Canadian Club in his glove box, and he took a drink. I started coughing, and he thought I was dying, and having, you know, and I coughed some more, and I coughed some more, and he finally got the drift and gave me a drink. And all of a sudden, teaching became a whole lot easier, you know. that was his only drink of the day. But for me, that was the green light that if I could drink with the principal, I could drink with everybody in between. I found out where the janitor kid hid his bottle. I knew where the art teacher kept her stuff. I knew where the shop teacher kept his jugs. And we even got permission from the principal to keep a six-pack of beer in the refrigerator because we played basketball once a week, and we could have a drink after a beer after the practice. It took about 8 cases of beer a week to keep that six-pack in the refrigerator. And we were going for it. And we were going, and we were happy, you know. And my kids saw every movie that was ever made by the Board of Education, you know. And didn't have to do anything at all to do with government. And I remember once a librarian said, "What are you showing a movie about France for?" I said, "Well, they need to be a good citizen there, too, you know, if they ever go." So they saw every movie, and they got great grades because I didn't want any problems. You know, I figured if they got good grades and they were happy and their parents were happy and I was still drinking, I was happy. Got my first political discussion with my father about this same time. Here I am. I'm working at this time. I'm actually working 2 full-time jobs. I'm teaching school and working for the A&P, making about $40,000 a year. I'm filling my own oats. I'm grown up. I'm a teacher now. I'm an educator. You know, I don't have to listen to my father rant and rave. And so one night while we were having a discussion about politics, I told him that my generation was going to fix the mistake of his. I woke up on the front lawn and when my father threw a suitcase and it hit me in the head, you know, and all my stuff was around me. And he had thrown me out of his house and everything else that I owned out of the house. And he told me that my generation lived out there. So I made a decision to move. You know, that's how alcoholics make decisions. After the decision has been made, we go ahead and say, "Well, I'm leaving." Well, that was not any great news flash to him. He knew I was leaving. So I moved out, and I moved to my first apartment. I was a GQ drunk. You know, my kids in school never saw me wear the same suit twice. You know, I was stylish. I had all the, and you know, I went out and got my first apartment and bought all those essentials. I bought a round bed, a pool table, and a black leather bar. And I was ready, you know. Got my first apartment, had all new clothes. I used to rent 2-bedroom apartments because I couldn't do things like laundry. So I would throw all the empty, dirty clothes into the spare bedroom and hope that some young lady I was dating named Honey would come along and do laundry for me. Never worked, you know. But that's the way I was living my life. You know, I had lots of money. You know, rent was about $125 a month. I owned my own car. Life was good, you know. And yet somehow, I kept getting evicted. The IBM Club, the I've Been Moved. I am one of the charter members of the I've Been Moved Club. I got evicted from every apartment I ever rented. Every single one. You know, it took me years to find out that you could actually move without having to find the stuff on the sidewalk. You know, but you could, you know, I'd come home and there it was. And I couldn't understand it because I always had money. But managing and doing those simple things like paying bills, it just was a mess. It's a nightmare. There was a pattern. And my own family was aware of the pattern before I was. About every 3 months, I would be evicted. You know, and so they would come by about every 2 months and see my car was still there. I was still in the same place. Life was good. You know, they didn't come inside. They didn't want to check that close. But they knew life was good because I still was where they could find me. One day, I'm sitting outside, and I had a routine when I got evicted. I would call some friends. They'd bring a truck, and we'd move down to the next apartment complex. And I was sitting outside, and my sister drove by, and it had only been like a week since I had moved in. And her reaction wasn't shocked that I was being evicted. It was that you can't be being evicted. It's too soon. And as an alcoholic, of course, I lied to her. I said, "This isn't my stuff. I'm watching it for someone else." She goes, "That's your pool table, and that's your bar, and nobody else is around that." You know, and you know, I said, "It's not what it looks like." You know, isn't that what we always say? It's not what it looks like. You know, and it was. It was exactly what it looked like. It was just a mess. And I quit teaching school because I wanted to drink more than I wanted to teach, which was the bottom line decision for everything every career move I ever made. I have no idea how many careers I eventually ended up with. When I got sober and I came back and I filled in an application. If any of y'all are newly sober and you know how you fill out those applications, left for management style differences, you know, looking for a better path for career advancement, all those things we put on the application, you don't want to put down. They were looking for me for the missing $50. You know, you don't put that stuff down. But I went in and I filled out this application in this place once when I got sober, and I came in and the guy came out and said, "We'd love to hire the guy on this piece of paper, but we can't hire you." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, you worked here." Now, I don't remember working there. But they remembered me working there, and I have to take their word for it. They didn't look like they would lie about it. And so that was the pattern. I had every job you could think of. I was a roofer, a painter, a teacher, managed grocery stores and smaller grocery stores and 7-Elevens and Highs and anybody that would, you know. I was a barber once for about an hour and a half. I probably still owe some amends for that. You know, some guys walking around these that might, should have grown out by now. And just all of that nonsense that was going on. And I was a wonderful fellow to date. I called all the women I dated honey, because I mean, I was a sweet person. I'd call them honey. And it usually lasted about a week and a half, the relationship. I had no idea what a long-term relationship was. Now, I had this terrible time, like, showing up, like, on the same day the date was scheduled, you know, or leaving after the date. And that's another thing. I kind of liked it where I was at, and I didn't want to go home, you know, or all those other things, that social skills that I just had none of. And it was a mess. And I'd cover it up with new clothes and stylish stuff. I had a pair of, you know, all those stacked shoes, you know, I hadn't had those. I had the glass old ones that you put the goldfish in that would swim around. Don't ever let anybody ever tell you that fish, you can drink like a fish. Because one time I used to put alcohol in the soles when I was going places you weren't allowed to drink that. And I put the fish in with the gin, and the fish died, went straight up. And fish can't hold their liquor at all. But I'd have the fish in the shoes, and I'd have the gin in the shoes and the rum. And it was just... it was really just a mess, you know. It was a nightmare. And all the legal troubles. I was telling a friend the other day about, you know, one time I was sitting outside of a bar. It was so bad that a bar had given us a case of beer to leave. You know, and that's pretty bad. When they pay you to leave, they give you beer. And we were sitting outside, and a fight started, and then my brother was in town. And I went to my van and got my brother's gun. He had a .45, and I went and fired two warning shots in the air and put a hole in my own van. That's hard to explain. I still can't figure that out. And that was the way life was going. It was just an accident that was getting worse. And jobs were getting worse, and it was harder to find places to live. And it was so and the pool table didn't work anymore, and the bar was broken. All the little glass pieces were gone, and then I got to the point where I couldn't rent a place on my own name anymore. You get that roommate status. You ever got to that point where, you know, you have to move in on somebody's sofa and pay half the rent? And it was just a nightmare. And I moved in with this guy, and it's kind of weird. His wife had left him because he was hanging out too much with me. So I moved in, and she was thrilled to death about that. And I suggested they get family counseling, and the counselor had the audacity to suggest I move out. And that was scary because I had no idea where I was going to go. Had absolutely no idea where I was going to go next. And I was dating this woman at the time. I was always dating some woman at a time. And she worked in a bar. She had just moved down from Pennsylvania to Maryland and was working in a bar while she was trying to get a job in her own field as a florist. And she knew I loved her because I came in to see her every day. And I'd write her little love notes on the napkins, on the cocktail napkins, and tell her how much I cared about her. And you know, now I'm getting evicted from roommate, and I have no idea what to do. And I thought about it, and I said, you know what, you need to get married. And she had two kids, and I thought, well, that'd be good. I'll be the Brady Bunch. We'll have a family, and we'll have children of our own. But I wanted to be careful about this, so I went over, and she had a house. Now, to me, this was, you know, very, very serious, because I've seen a lot of people evicted from apartments, but once you get in a house, you're home free, you know? So I was beginning to think that this might be the one, you know? So I went down and I looked at her and I wanted to be sure, and I am a spoiled brat to this day. I do not eat vegetables. You know, green vegetables and me have nothing in common. And I would look and I went open her refrigerator and looked in the vegetable crisper, and she had Miller Lite. So I asked her to marry me on the spot. And to my surprise, she accepted, and we called my parents, and they got in the car and came right over to her place. My father wanted to take us to Virginia because we could get married the same day, and my mother wanted to talk her out of it. My mom, this little Irish Catholic woman, said, just live with him, honey. It won't take long. But I told Mary that she'd come to love her too, just like I did. And we went to Virginia and got married. And it was just a wonderful marriage for about an hour and a half. I went out the first day that we got married to go get some bread and milk because we were going to leave on our honeymoon about 2 days later. And I didn't get home that same night. Somehow I ran into a friend who wanted to celebrate my wedding, and then we ran into another friend, and next thing I know, it was 6 o'clock the next morning, and I'm going home, and this woman is up, and she's insanely angry. And I'm saying, I said, I just went out for bread and milk, you know, what are you upset about, you know? I got home, you know, and that became the pattern of our marriage, you know? It became like, we today are still, I'm still married to the same woman, I'll jump ahead, and we only celebrate the years I've been in the fellowship. She tells me I didn't have enough time and resonance to celebrate the years before we got married, before I got sober. And it became this nightmare. I didn't get us evicted from that house, but we had to move out of it. We moved out of that into a townhouse, into an apartment, to a house I rented over the phone. That was a log cabin that they had put siding around, that the floors went up and down like that. And it was just a nightmare. I moved our daughter. Our older two children had moved on to get out of our lives, but I moved our young daughter into that house, and it was a nightmare. We put our young daughter into private school because Mary wanted some stability in her life, and there wasn't any in me. And so she thought, well, maybe if we get her into a private school, it'll help. And I'm still just drinking and thinking I'm just not hurting anybody but myself. And we get a call from this Christian school asking us to come in. And I'm, you know, alcoholics usually have the right answer to the wrong question. All the way down there, I'm telling Mary, Corinna's not applying herself. She's not taking advantage of this opportunity that we're sacrificing to give her. And I wasn't sacrificing anything. And yet, here we go, and we get into the school, and the principal calls us into the office and lets me know that he's calling the police to press charges against me for beating my daughter. And I was shocked. You know, my father's a violent drunk. I've never raised my hand at Corinna. It was just appalling to think that would even be suggested. And this nice party drunk who never hurt anybody but himself had upset my daughter so much that she was beating herself to try and get help for her family. She wanted me out of her life that bad. And that's, I would love to tell you, was the straw that broke the camel's back and got me to quit drinking. But I drank at that for a long time. I was just angry at that. I was hurt at that. And I didn't know how to process those type of feelings or emotions. So I drowned them with booze. And I drank in them more and more and more. There was a point in my life where I used to believe that the police were out looking for me, that they had my license plate on their dashboards to arrest me. But that's not the case. It's not hard to catch a drunk driver. I got pulled over by a fire truck once, you know. I was driving on the wrong side of the road, and the fire truck pulled me over because, you know, they were on the right side, and they thought, you might want to come back over this way. And I ended up with 7 DWIs and one drunk while walking. you know, I got a DWI when I drove down the road on a sidewalk and pulled off the sidewalk and got in a crash. And it was just a nightmare. You know, it's so tiring now to look back at that and think all that made sense. And it was getting worse and worse and worse, and I didn't know what to do about it. You know, my wife really was a florist, and she had opened her own flower shop, and she was supporting the family. And then, an amazing coincidence, a drunk driver hit her, and she couldn't work. And then she was in a second accident about 4 days later because she had a big check coming into her shop, and she had gotten out of bed and drove down to the shop to pick it up because she was scared to death I would find it. You know, I had become this thief that just taking the money that she gave me was no longer enough. I had to steal from my own family. You know, it took me, I think it was about 3 years sober before she got rid of vinyl purses where she would take her own purse into the shower to make sure the money was still there, that she could trust that. It took that time, you know, and here that was going on, and it was just horror going on. And I got, like I said, 7 DWIs and a drunk while walking. I got the drunk while walking, and I thought, man, it's getting really hard to get around when they arrest you. I was walking down the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, a 60-mile-an-hour speed limit road, and all of a sudden, I heard a siren on the gravel behind me, and I looked back, and it was a park policeman, and I went back to the window, and I asked him how fast I was going, and he put me in the back seat of the car, and I was used to that, and got in the back seat, and got arrested, and You just couldn't catch a break. Is what alcoholics always say. I couldn't catch a break. I was walking. You know, I was trying to get along with people. I got a drunk and disorderly in a phone booth and all the other, you know, screaming at a wrong number. You know, what do you mean she's not there? I know she's there. You know, and all that nonsense. And it was just the same thing kept happening. I went to court for my 60 WI, and I used to wear this blue suit and get a haircut to go to the court, and they didn't take stuff as seriously back then. They had a little bit of leeway, and the judge said, you know, he said something that had never been said to me before. He said, give me one good reason why I should not put you in jail today. And I hadn't heard the word jail before. I'd heard fines. I'd heard alcoholic education. I'd heard, you know, maybe even possibly a rehab, but he's talking about jail. Jail's for criminals. I'm just a nice guy who drinks too much. And I said, well, my family needs me. And he looked at me and he said, what for? And I didn't have an answer. I said, well, I didn't know it was going to be a quiz, you know, so I didn't know why my family needs me, you know. And he said, well, where are they? And of course they weren't there. Why would they come to court with me? They needed me out of their life. They didn't really want me in it. And I said, judge, I don't know why they need me, but I know they need me. He said, I'm going to give you 30 days to answer that question. And if you come back in 30 days and don't answer that, I am going to put you in jail. Now, we hadn't even talked about drinking up to this point. And I promised him, I said, your honor, if you give me a break and if you let me go home and figure this out, I promise you I will never, ever drink again. And you're going to strap the polygraph to me and it will come up 100% true. I did not ever want another drink. 4 days later, I got my last DWI. It was a 3-2. I was on my way to work. There was a taillight out. You know, those taillights were always getting meaning to get around and fixing. And the police officer noticed the taillight out and came up beside me and he said, you know, he noticed a strong smell and aroma of alcohol, and he noticed my beer can collection in the back seat, and I couldn't sell him on the recycling aluminum. And he gets me out of the car, and right across the street from where he stops me is the place I'm going to work. I'm just going right there. That's where and the guys I was supposed to let into the store were right there waving at me. They thought this was hilarious. You know, hey, we don't have to work tonight, and he's drunk again. And he goes, 3-2. He said, you're not drunk. I said, I know I'm not drunk. There's something got to be wrong with the machine, because there's always something wrong with the machine. We're not drunk. Only had a couple. And he let me go on my own reconnaissance. And you know what? I went home. My wife was in the hospital at that time. My daughter was with my sister because she couldn't be allowed to stay with me. And I thought to myself, you know what? I'm in real trouble now. I know that the company that I worked for had told me one more time in trouble and you are unemployed. So I knew I was unemployed. I knew the first judge was going to be really unimpressed that I got a DWI after I promised him I would never drink again. And I knew the second judge wasn't going to be impressed, you know, any more than the first. And so I made this wise decision to run away from home. And I'm going to leave everybody behind, and I'm going to be magnanimous about it. And I wrote this beautiful note. I've hurt you all enough. I'm taking off, and I love you, and I'll love you forever, but this just isn't working, and you deserve better than this. You know, love, Johnny, you know, and left that note and then took all the cash that we had left because, you know, magnanimous and cash aren't quite related. And figured I was going either to California or Florida, and I was trying to figure that out. And it was a little bar called the Starting Gate where I went in to try and think because I always thought better at a bar. And next thing I knew, all the cash was gone because that's the way I drink. I drank one more till it was all gone. And I drove the car till it ran out of gas, and I spent a year of my life living on the street with not having enough sense to come in out of the rain. It was horrific. When I got to prison, I weighed 98 pounds, and I had hair all the way down my back and a beard all the way down the front, and I was dying out there. I had too much pride to hold up a sign, "We'll work for food." I used to sit in libraries and stink and hope that they wouldn't throw me out and sit there and hold books at the same page that I had read before and go to the library and sit there for 8 or 9 hours and just try and stay warm. I found this gas station that had an empty tire pit and behind the gas station. I would crawl down there at night after all the lights went out and sneak over the wall and call that home. I would eat food out of dumpsters and and live on the street and was dying and couldn't figure out how I got to here, how I had gone from the University of Maryland to teaching kids to living on the street without a clue of what to do next. And that's where it took me. And I used to have all these regrets, and I would think, wow, you know, if I could just figure this out, you know, if I could just get someone that would help. And when I was sitting up there in the woods looking down and waiting for those lights to go out so I could go home behind this gas station, the only other lights on in this little town was a cross on a local church. And throughout our marriage, my wife used to bring different pastors into our home to talk to me on a regular basis. And we'd go to different churches on a Sunday. We had a deal. She'd buy me beer on Saturday if I'd go to church with her on Sunday, you know. And so I'd be hungover. I'd be the hungover drunk in the front row in the 11 o'clock service. And I began to remember all those things those pastors had talked about. And I saw this church. And I saw the way that they greeted one another, you know. I looked there one Sunday morning, and they would all hug one another, and they just seemed to love one another, and they'd reach out, and some of them would bring in picnic baskets, and they'd have parties after church out on the lawn. And I thought, you know, I'm going there, and I'm going to get some help, because I need some help, and they're going to love me because they're supposed to love me. And I went up there the next Sunday morning, and I walked up that dirt road to that church, and I was getting close, and somebody on the front porch saw me coming, and they went inside, and next thing I know, there's six men in a circle around me, and they asked me what I'm doing there. And I told them, I don't know, I just know I need something. And they asked me again, what are you doing here? And I said, no, I really don't know, I just know I need something. And they agreed I needed something, but they knew it wasn't there, and they asked me to look for it somewhere down the road. It's the last time I really remember swearing. And I wasn't swearing at them. I was swearing at myself for thinking that I could hang out with normal, decent people like that. And I walked down that dirt road and cursed my way all the way down that road and thinking that, you know, you're nothing but a bum and you don't deserve to be around normal people. And I walked down and would have probably died out in the street, but ran into some old friends, and there was an alcoholic with a plan. This plan that you can rob the store that we're managing and we'll split the money later. And so they got me a toy gun. I'm going to rob a store with a toy gun, which went over real well. And the next time I know, I'm in jail because of our plan. There's nothing worse than an alcoholic with a plan, and I'm going to jail. And here I am in jail, and it was my worst nightmare. I'm a GQ drunk. GQ drunks don't end up in jail. And here I am, and they're putting on this. Now, I had at one time like 150 suits of clothes, and they're going to give me one gray suit that doesn't even fit and tell me the and they're going to give me a King James Version Bible and a big book. And they're going to put me in here and lock me up here. And it just didn't seem to fit, you know, who I was. And it was exactly what I needed. I like jail. You know, I like jail. It was warm. You know, it didn't rain on your head. They fed you there. They blew a whistle so you didn't have to wonder when it was time to eat. You didn't have to make those decisions. They blew the whistle and it was time to eat. You didn't have to make choices of what they ate because you ate what they gave you, and it wasn't ever enough. And you lived a lot of your life hungry and missing and wanting more. And I was in there, and for the first month or so, I just sat there minding my own business. And then I got more and more comfortable, and I started writing letters to guys. And you got two phone calls a day, and I would go up to the phone because I didn't want anyone to know I was, you know, lonely and scared to death and had no one left. And I would call time and weather and talk to the weather lady for 5 or 10 minutes. And, you know, hope nobody heard the beep that it was now 9:32, you know, and go through that charade of nonsense that I was living this lie. And I stayed there. And I might have, you know, I was kind of getting comfortable there. And I thought, you know, when your time is up for this, you'll just tell them all the other things that you've done. And you might spend, you know, 10 or 12 years in jail, and you can figure the rest of life out later. And that was my goal at this point. And then they brought a bunch of kids through from what they Scared Straight program. And it was a really, really significant day in my life. They brought these kids through, and they would come by before, and they'd say, look, if you guys act like real animals, we'll give you two desserts tonight. You know, and these guys acted like real animals for dessert or not. I mean, they were pretty much animals, and I was one of them. And they were screaming at these kids, and the kids walked by as close as you are to me, Dom, and they would walk by. And this one kid stopped, And he stared and he looked right through me. And he was scared to death. And he wasn't afraid of me. He was afraid that if he didn't change his life, he could become me. And it was my moment of clarity. I saw exactly what I had done with the life that I had been given. And I was scared to death. I didn't know if there was any hope that things could get different or things could get better. Yeah. In prison, you have to sign up. So I signed up for an AA meeting and was allowed to go. And I stole a copy of How It Works. I'm pretty sure if I'd have asked, you know, I don't want you to think this is some instant recovery. If I'd have asked, they'd give me a whole big book, you know. They'd give me anything I want just to show interest. And so I stole a copy of How It Works. And I came back and I saw there was a lot of stuff about God. Now, I'd been to AA meetings, but I hadn't really paid any attention. And so here I went back and I signed up to go to a prison service. And I went to this prison service, and there was a little 5'2" chaplain who talked to us and seemed really friendly and seemed to really care for us. And said at the end of his message that if anybody would like to talk to me, just raise your hand and I'll come by tomorrow. And he was 5'2". So I thought, oh, I can handle him. You know, he doesn't intimidate me, so I raised my hand. And God always knows best. And the next day, the assistant prison chaplain, who was 6'6 and 285, showed up in prison on December 23rd, 1983. The whole prison was gray. The walls were gray, the floors were gray, the uniforms were gray, and he came in his bright Hawaiian shirt and khaki shorts. And I just smiled at him, and he smiled at me, and he asked me how I'm doing. I said, I'm doing fine. I said, son, you're in jail. You're not doing all that well. And I told him, I said, no, it's gotten better because before I was out in the street, before that I was in the bottle, and it's really getting better. And I said, and he said, well, how about turning your life over to the care of God? And I said, I'm going to do that as soon as I get through a few more things worked out. And he said, well, God takes chaos and turns it into order, and your gift seemed to be in the opposite direction. You take anything that is orderly and make it pretty chaotic, and you need to accept God as where you're at, not where you hope to be. And so he started talking to me, and he talked to me about this Roman road, and I started crying. I hadn't cried in years. And I felt these tears running down my face, and he looked at me and he asked me why I was crying. I said, because that sounds so wonderful. He said, then why are you crying? I said, because I'm not eligible. And I told him about that church that had rejected me, and they wouldn't let me in the building. And then he started crying. And he said, sometimes the people of God forget how long God's arms really are. You know, and I put my arms through the cell block, through the bars in the cell, and he held on to my arms, and we said a sinner's prayer. I missed the mark, powerless over alcohol, and I made a decision. I worked my first three steps, December 23rd, 1983, and it was an amazing gift. And I went back to my cell block, and I was scared to death. And I woke up the next morning, and I felt something I didn't even know. I couldn't recognize it. I couldn't explain it. And today I know it was hope. I got hope. And I'd ask him, he asked me if there was anything I wanted God to do for me. And I said, I don't want to ever drink again. I don't want to ever use drugs again. I don't want to ever smoke again. Now, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm going to turn that page and close that chapter in my life. And later that day, they brought in, it was Christmas Eve, 1983, and they brought in this little brown paper bag into the cell block. And it had 7 pieces of penny candy, a single pack of instant coffee, a comb and a pack of cool cigarettes. Cigarettes back then probably cost about 50 cents. The whole thing probably cost about 60. And I went back to my cell block and I gave the cigarettes away. They didn't fit my life anymore. And all of a sudden I knew that God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. You know, it's amazing when you begin to recognize, when you begin to surrender, when you recognize that you're powerless, but you come to believe that there is one who has all power. And things began to happen. Charges against me got dropped. Just miraculously dropped, you know. And then early in 1984, they came by and they called my name and they said, you're being released from prison. I said, really? No one told me anything. And I said, well, it was really exciting until I recognized I had nowhere to go. So they gave me about 5 minutes to gather my stuff. And I went up and I called the only number I knew, my sister. And Sandy answered the phone and she was hysterical. For 2 years, my family had not heard from me. They had visited morgues to see if that unidentified body was their husband, their brother, their father, their son. And that is the hell that I put my family through. And my sister asked me what was going on. I told her, hey, look, I just want you all to know I'm okay. I'm leaving prison. I love you all very much. And And I just didn't want to leave without doing that and taking that opportunity. And she said, stay where you are, Midge, her husband. He's on his way. He'll pick you up. Well, by the time he got there, there were these other guards standing in the back of the prison waiting room. These things called FTAs, failure to appear. The way I used to look at it, prisons were busy and courts were busy and I was busy. So let's just forget about it and let bygones be bygones. They don't forget anything on your record. So I had to get bailed out of three prison systems that day. My brother-in-law, I walked out of the fourth prison that day at 9 o'clock that night and walked down. In the conversation with my sister, she asked me what I wanted to tell Mary, my wife, and I just said, tell her I love her and whatever she wants, I'll understand. Mary was scheduled to leave for Florida 3 days later. I don't know if I ever would have found her again. I don't know how I would have ever found her again. And my life would have been so much less if I hadn't. And just an amazing gift, and talks about the timing and the power of God. So I got out and I went home and I saw my wife, and she looked at me and she could see something had changed. And we went home and she could see past the beard and the hair, and she cut my hair and I got a razor and shaved. And the next day I went and I joined a local church and a local AA group. And the local church didn't tell me to stay out of AA, and AA didn't tell me to stay out of church. And I started to learn how to live as a sober member of society. And I started to learn how to surrender through the steps, and surrender to the fact that we're powerless, and surrender to the fact that we're hopeless, and surrender to the fact that even sober, my best decisions will not be the best decisions that I can make. And to take a strong and personal inventory and find out that, wow, I need to know who the vessel is that's been pouring booze all his life trying to fill this hole. I need to find out who I really was, and I need to share that fact with another human being. I need to recognize that my drunk tools that I used to use, that I used to call them character assets, really weren't assets at all. They were just things that I was using to try and force my will into other circumstances and relationships. And I learned had to make some amends for my past. And I had to learn, and I made a list of all those folks. And then I had to learn to continue to maintain this life. And that's where we started at. And over the years, that's where we grow. We grow through the steps. We surrender to God, and then we look at these steps. There's 12 steps that I believe with all my heart are firmly part of the will of God. And we go out and we find a job. You know, and that's hard. I didn't really want to go look for a job because I had to go back to court for a couple more times. But my lawyer told me it would really inspire him if he thought he might get paid. And so, you know, it's hard to go knocking on a door when you're going back to jail because you're guilty. And I've got to tell them the truth. When they ask, are you guilty? I'm going to say, yeah, I'm guilty. You know, I was guilty. You know, and so I'm knocking on doors looking for jobs. And I finally came across this guy that had once worked for me. So I thought, well, this will work. And, you know, he worked for me. I thought we had a great relationship. And he laughed when I asked him for a job. He said, why in the world would I hire you? So our relationship wasn't as strong as I thought, you know. I said, oh, it seemed like a good idea to me, but, you know. And he laughed again. He said, there's no way in the world. I don't even want you shopping here. That hurt. So I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm sorry for the wrong that I've done you, and I apologize, and I'll get out of your way. And I started walking out, and there was a liquor store right next to the store, and I walked right past it, and he had come out because he knew I was walking in the liquor store. And he followed me to my car, and he said, he looked at me, and he said, look, I'm going to hire you because I want the privilege of firing you. And I was so desperate for a job, I took it. And there wasn't a whole lot of career motive in that, and I wasn't really sure how long it would last, but I had a job. I went home, and I showed up, and he said, the first time you're late, you're fired. First time you don't come back from lunch, you're fired. First time, you know, anything's wrong, it's your fault. You know, there's no gray area here. You're gone. Yes, sir. So I showed up 10 minutes early for work every day, and he watched me every day. And he went back, and he picked up my time clock every day, looked at my time card, and he checked it out. And one day I got to work early, and the assistant manager asked me about coming and help him. I said, well, I got to go punch in. He said, don't worry about it. I'll write you in later. And about 3 hours later, the boss came in and he came over and said, you didn't punch in, you're fired. And Ray said, no, I asked him to come and work for me. And about a month later, he recommended me for management because he said, you know, you're doing something right. See, that's the thing about recovery. When we start doing the right things, people see us doing the right things. And you get help from unlikely sources. in church. I became a Sunday school teacher, then a Sunday school director, then a deacon. And it was, and then I kept wondering, when is this training going to stop? I mean, because there's got to be more qualified people for me. There is a scripture that says God uses the foolish, but how far can I take that? There's got to be an end. I mean, you know, I know God's got a sense of humor, but enough is enough. And we're going through this, and life's getting... And then the store I was working for got sold, and I just couldn't get it. Then I started my own company, and then out of that own company, life got better. I got a chance to preach in the local church I was at, and I got an opportunity to go to seminary. And from seminary, I became a pastor, and I have been more blessed than I can ever imagine in that. In my family life, we moved back in after I left prison with my daughter, who... only allowed us to move in because her mother needed a place to stay, and we stayed in the basement and she stayed upstairs. And a few years later, she had noticed the difference. And a little bit after that, you know, she had to have surgery. And before she had surgery, she went and we signed papers that if she didn't come out of that brain surgery, I would raise her child, my granddaughter. You know, and she came through that brain surgery, and my granddaughter still lives with us. And I think she's going to end up in these rooms one day. My wife has had over 18 surgeries since we've been married. I mean, I've been sober. And I haven't had to get drunk over any of them. I had buried a mother, a father, a brother, and this last year, our son. Our son was given a week to live in hospice and lived for 18 months. And for 18 months, I was able to drive his mother 180 miles round trip down to say goodbye to her son and to my son and to make that amend not just to him but to her. And allow her to cry all the way home and to know that I was going to be there for her to take her wherever she needed to go. My daughter and I today have a wonderful relationship. My church and I today have a relationship that we want to intentionally interact our community with the transforming power of God that I learned about in here. My life today makes sense one day at a time. And it gets better. I've got a 4-year-old great-grandson that told me the other day he loves me more than anybody in the world. And he loves me more than anybody in the world. And he's never saw me drink and never will. My granddaughter's never seen me drink and never has to. Now, life gets better one day at a time. I don't go out a lot at night anymore. It's kind of funny. My mother would be so proud. It used to be that when we were kids growing up, one of the main rules I broke was to be home by the time the second streetlight came on. And I was never home by the time the second streetlight. One time we blew the second streetlight out, shot the bulb out, thinking it was going to be one of those few more minutes, you know. And I told the guys driving up tonight that, we're going to be home. We're not going to be home by the time the second streetlight comes out. And I stay home a lot of nights now because I love my family. You know, I love my family. I go out for ministry, and I go out for special occasions, and I thank God for this one because it's a wonderful reminder. You know, anniversaries are difficult times for us all. We look back and we try and think about where we were and where we are, about the journey that continues. You know, it is a journey. You know, it isn't a sprint. There have been more bad things happen to me sober than ever happened to me drunk. I've had to face more hardship and difficulty, but I learned very early on that the answer wasn't in the past. My father was 6 months sober, and when I was 6 months sober, I got my chip and went to show my dad and had discovered that he had died in his sleep. I went in, and I was the one that found him. My mother was sleeping out in the living room, and she went and told me to wake my dad up because he would be heartbroken if he didn't see that chip. And I went in, and I showed it to him and found out that he had died. And there was booze in the house. And I called someone in the fellowship that I didn't particularly admire, but I knew that would tell me the truth. And I couldn't ask for help yet, so I told him about all the commitments that I had. And he told me, gave me this simple advice, don't make it any worse. And I told him, so you don't understand, he's dead, it can't get any worse. He said, if you pick up a drink, it'll get worse. And I didn't pick up a drink, and I came to a meeting, and I found out that one day at a time, the power and the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous can get us through anything. Can get us through anything. You know? We are the most fortunate people in the world. I would love if I could get my church to have the personality of my home group. Because the masks are off in here. We become transparent with one another in here. We talk about the hardship and the heart in here. We don't put on our Sunday go-to-meeting clothes in here. We just simply come in and we tell folks, hey, I'm hurting. And I don't want to drink. And I'll do anything not to drink. And the one truth that I have learned is that if you don't pick up a drink, you can't get drunk. And if you come around long enough, there might be difficulties, but they're not the same difficulties. I went to court not long ago for a young man, and I'm going to shut up, but I'm the only one in the courtroom smiling. And, you know, the mom looks at me and goes, what are you smiling about? And I said, well, I know I'm going home. I'm not sure about Junior, but I know where I'm going at the end of the day. There is no guilt by association. And I went to court one other time, and I had written a letter, and the young person had asked me to write a letter as a pastor, and I was their pastor, so I wrote it. And the judge called me up front and said, Pastor, I really appreciate your letter, but you don't know anything about alcoholism. You know? You just don't know anything about alcoholism. And I said, well, excuse me, ma'am, but I do. She goes, everybody thinks that, but unless you're an alcoholic, you don't really understand it. I said, well, I am, and I've been sober for almost 29 years. She goes, well, why didn't you put that in a letter? She goes, well, I'm sorry, I apologize. And she got really angry at me and said, from now on, make sure besides the pastor that you remind the judge that you're an alcoholic, because we respect people that have gone through recovery and that are practicing these principles in all their affair, that have turned their will and their lives over to God of their understanding, that are sometimes it's the God of our misunderstanding or non-understanding, or we've associated religion and the people who claim to know God with the true God of our understanding, who loves us exactly where we're at and wants the best for us. And the best is never found at the bottom of the bottle. Thank you very much.